Having a hard time finding the right person for the new position at your company? Wasting your time interviewing a bunch of human turds? Sick and tired of reading resumes filled with typos, grammatical errors, and disgusting hardcore pornographic images? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then please consider using NipRecruiter to fill your company's open positions. NipRecruiter uses state-of-the-art AI-enhanced image scanning technologies to help you find the best employee for the job. Simply direct potential candidates to the NipRecruiter website, have them upload a high-resolution image of one or both of their nipples, and let NipRecruiter do the rest. Due to ongoing litigation, we are not legally allowed to explain how NipRecruiter's nip scanning system works, but trust me, it works. How do you think I got my job as a guy who makes fake commercials for this podcast? Try NipRecruiter today. Just go to niprecruiter.gov and sign up for your free 15-minute trial. You won't be disappointed. You're going to like the way you look. I guarantee it.
You have successfully connected to the Secret Society of Fly Tires podcast.
Hello and welcome. It's me again, delivering yet another podcast episode for your listening pleasure, available now on demand to listen to however, whenever, and wherever you want. And you know, I'm starting to question the pleasure part of that statement. Is anyone still here? I'm quickly realizing that I've been unknowingly testing my audience to see if they can hang with an annoying intro and very dumb subject matter in the first few episodes of Season 3 of this here show, Secret Society of Fly Tires. Have you passed the test?
Do not test me right now.
I'm obligated to say I hope so, because why else am I doing this? I'm trying my darndest to entertain, but if my already low listener numbers start to decline, that is fine. This season is going to help me quit smoking, and if I'm the only one to benefit from that, it's okay. And even if just one of you joins me in this quitting journey, that's even better.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
I made up a new word today, podcrastinating. That is when an idiotic podcast host fights with their own brain to create the content they signed up to deliver free of charge to a small group of like-minded buffoons. It's been harder to get motivated and create this season than it was in the first two. My quote-unquote sophomore slump is the time between seasons 2 and 3, I guess. It's a careful balance of finding free time to dedicate to writing very stupid monologues, book interviews and prep for them, and feeling creatively inspired. Today I feel inspired, not just because I have a few funny things to share, but because today's topic is one I recently became interested in. It's perfect timing. My good buddy Jim Sens told me that I should interview Joel Hill about tube flies, and that was all the convincing I needed. When Jim talks, I listen. It didn't take long for me to realize how badass Joel is behind the vise, and his talent was confirmed again when I interviewed Jonathan Farmer to kick off this season, as he had a few flies tied by Joel on his desk that he thought were great. I'm not sure I can think of two better endorsements in that zone. I feel kind of ashamed to say that I hadn't heard of Joel yet, so I started doing my usual research to prep for our chat, and I soon realized that I had a very talented dude to interview. I tell you all often that I'm not a pro. I'm still learning like I imagine a lot of you are, so don't beat me up too bad for not preparing as well as I should have.
I'll end you!
For instance, I totally neglected to learn that he had been featured in a fairly well-known fly tying book, John Shuey's Spey Flies, Their History and Construction, a book I will soon own. I like spey flies and their history and their construction. I'm the host of a fly tying podcast, remember? Anyways, I embarrassed myself, but just a little. And if you have low self-esteem, how badly can you really embarrass yourself? A cowardly podcast host would have edited that shit right out, but I bear myself unto thee in all of my stupidity.
I'm embarrassing you?
Yes.
So, like I just mentioned, my initial angle was to talk to Joel about tying tube flies and sort of narrowing in on more classic steelhead patterns that he adapted to the tube platform, as opposed to an old-school long shank hook. Once we connected, we drilled down even further and decided to make the subject of this episode about the general practitioner.
What is a general practitioner?
That is a great question, lady. Allow me to read through a little bit of history on the pattern for folks like me who are still relatively green on this one. I found a nice write-up on wildsteelheaders.org from Sean Dahlquist, who I believe is a buddy of my guest, Joel. Perfect, right? Here it goes. The original general practitioner, or GP, was devised nearly 70 years ago by Mr. Esmond Drury, an English salmon fisherman. Drury had recently harvested a pile of prawns and decided to try and replicate one at the Vice. After a considerable time at his fly tying desk, Drury eventually produced a pattern that pleased him. On his first outing with his new creation, he hooked 4 salmon and landed 3. Like many English salmon patterns before it, the GP eventually made its way to the US and Canada, where it quickly became a popular East Coast salmon fly, and was also adopted readily by the steelhead and salmon fishermen of the Pacific Northwest. Drury's original dressing for the general practitioner is extremely complex, time-consuming, and difficult to tie. Sean went on to explain in the article that he distilled a version of the GP down to a quick, easy, and durable tie that he feels holds true to its intended prawn-like silhouette. Originally tied with red macaw tail fiber feelers, today they are typically replaced with a small bunch of dyed orange bucktail.
Bucktail, bucktail, bucktail. So you know how much hair is in it, but for those of you who don't know, bucktails for bucktails.
Drury's tie has several segments of golden pheasant tippets and flank feathers with palmer dyed orange rooster hackles throughout. This is typically reduced and simplified. Dressing the GP on shanks and tubes has also become popular. Over the years, this pattern has accounted for innumerable fish and has been modified in every imaginable way, and tied in a multitude of colors. I think it's safe to say that no two anglers tie it exactly alike, but it is always fished with the same amount of confidence. I can confirm that just by the 5 GPs that Joel tied and sent to me. They're all different and all equally fishy. Wow. I gotta pat myself on the back because I'm already doing better this episode with actually talking about tying flies than the first couple episodes of season 3. I felt like I owed you all one where I don't just ramble about farting and dick tattoos. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know most of you yet. Maybe you'd rather just listen to my nonsense. Don't worry, this monologue is still gonna be chock full of absolute nonsense.
Reading is for idiots, we all know that. But books can still be cool. It's a conundrum, I bet. I don't know for sure what that word means, but I'm gonna assume that it's applicable to this scenario. Anyway, don't read books. Listen to them. Did you know that you can download the audio of somebody else reading a book so you can just listen to them reading it instead of having to read it yourself? You can continue to watch television or drive drunk or watch pornography while you've got the sound of somebody reading a book playing in the background. That's what books were meant for. That's how authors want you to ingest their work. And here's the good news. You can now download audiobooks read by the host of the Secret Society of Fly Tiers. He isn't making money from this podcast, and he lost his real job because he got caught driving drunk while watching pornography, so his loss is your gain. Just head on over to booksreadbyanidiot.com and download one of over 6 books that he's recorded himself reading. Choose from titles like The Wettest Night in the World by Albert Einsteinstein, The World is a Vampire by William Corrigan, and The Bible by Jesus Christ. Download an audiobook today. You won't regret it. And if you do, I do not care.
I'm assuming most of you don't have a podcast where you air all your weird dirty laundry like me. And if you do, I don't listen to it. I have my own very successful brand to worry about, and I can't have a bunch of similar programs influencing my precious content. That is 2 jokes in one if you didn't catch it, because my brand is not successful at all, and my content is stupid. I love being stupid, you guys.
I need for us to treat each other like we're not gentlemen and that we're very, very stupid.
Speaking of stupid, I got my first real shout out on Reddit recently. Well, I probably shouldn't say recently because who the hell knows when this episode will be released, but I'm writing it in February and a new friend of the show named Spencer gave me a shout out in my favorite stupid subreddit, Fly Fishing Circle Jerk. I'd bet good money that most of you fools subscribe to it. Why the hell didn't you beat my dude Spencer to the punch and give me a shout? Shame on you. I don't really want to shame anyone, but that sub is perfect for my show. It's full of dumb jokes, like people asking what fly to use in absurd bodies of water and referring to Tom Rosenbauer as our personal lord and savior. The only downside to that sub now being aware of me is that I can't steal any of their jokes anymore. I'm kidding, I don't steal, but I really should have been because that sub makes me laugh pretty much every day. Kudos to the folks who admin it and contribute, and thanks to Spencer for throwing me in the mix. I appreciate it big time.
Thank you.
I also recently realized that I've grown to love the sound design aspect of this show. I like bringing my episodes to life with music and movie clips and sound effects. which reminds me that I've been forgetting to modulate my voice like this. See how funny and cool this is? I don't even have to say anything of substance. Why are you listening to this trash? Ha 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 ha. I'm kidding. I'm not trash. I'm a man. My guest isn't trash either. Far from it. He's polite, talented, and allowed me to ask stupid questions about keeping the portions of your fly tying materials uniform and was not offended that I didn't know he was in a really cool fly tying book. Plus, he sent me some awesome GP tube flies that he crafted up himself. I can't wait to fish them. And I will fish them, even though they're almost too rad to fish. I'm going all in on the tubes.
I am a big fan of tubes.
Hey, Maddie, did you make a New Year's resolution? Like maybe to stop being such a fucking idiot every day of your life?
My only real New Year's resolution for 2024 was to fish tube flies whenever I'm swinging. So far, I've stuck to it, too. I haven't caught a steelhead this year yet, but it'll happen. I hope, for the love of God. Even just one steelhead a year is okay for me, honestly. That's how low my expectations are. It is so nice to have low expectations in this sport. Plus, to me, swinging flies is the most enjoyable way to spend a day out on the river. I'm tubing all of 2024, folks. Join me if you're not too scared to paint yourself into the same type of corner as me.
This is the Tube of Terror.
I got a question for y'all. Why are you scared?
My corner is where smokers go to smoke their stupid, expensive, delicious cigarettes. I don't have much of an update on my mission to quit smoking yet. I am still smoking a lot of Parliament brand cigarettes. I hate that my gas station knows that I want them when I walk in. They know me as a guy who probably smokes all the Parliaments they order from their cigarette czar or smoke superintendent. One method of quitting I read about is replacement. They say to find something healthy to replace your unhealthy habit with. Which sounds easy on paper, but the habit I want to use as a replacement is doing yoga. I'm not embarrassed to say that. It feels great. I like stretching, okay? Get off of my back. I like stretching while a calming female voice is telling me what to do and encouraging me. I have two children, though, and ran out of room at my house. I'm a tall guy that is mostly made of bones. I'm like 0% muscle, 80% bone, 10% smoke, 5% water, and 5% fat because I eat ice cream cones every night of my life.
I saw you eating ice cream, pal. Oh, don't you deny it. You're eating an ice cream cone.
Got a call yesterday from Baskin-Robbins. They said that they're down to only 5 flavors. Hello, ice cream. Having a good time? Running around?
I really hope I don't write season 4 about quitting sugar. I love sugar more than cigarettes. Anyways, I was saying I'm tall and lanky, and yoga requires you to kind of stretch all the way out.
Yeah, I'm looking for a place to spread out here.
I don't know what that means, spread out.
I need a room.
I also like to do yoga in the dark. I don't know why, so don't ask me. I'm a special boy, all right?
My special, special boy.
So, until I build my yoga studio here at my house, I either need to pay to go somewhere and stretch and fart with a bunch of strangers, or find another alternative. Lucky for me, I have great friends, and one of them suggested that I replace my cigarettes with anabolic steroids, and it's a fantastic idea. We all saw what they did to Major League Baseball players.
Do I think steroids are good for helping someone's performance? No. Let me be clear. I've never taken steroids or HGH.
The host of this podcast, the man you know as Marty,
is my friend. He was my friend before this. He will be my friend after this.
Barry Bonds grew 2 hat sizes and 2 shoe sizes and obliterated baseballs into the disgusting water of McCovey Cove after allegedly using all kinds of steroids. It's truly a win-win situation. Except for Barry Bonds, because even though he's the MLB home run king, everyone still hates him.
Hundreds of MLB players took steroids. Barry Bonds, however, is the only one to get sentenced to house arrest for lying about it.
Anyways, it's a win-win for me because I'd finally kick cigarettes to the curb and I would grow huge, sexy muscles.
Finally, you wimp.
My wife would be attracted to me again. My kids would respect me. My neighbors would fear me. I would be the perfect, non-smoking, human specimen. The scaredy cats out there will tell me that the associated risk outweighs the benefits, but I'm 43 years old and literally don't have anything to lose. they sure as hell won't be taking away my podcast. No one can. If I was canceled, I would still record these episodes and I would just burn CDs and mail them to all of you. I'm on the road to 1 million words, remember? And I will stop at nothing to achieve my goal. Anabolic steroids will absolutely help me achieve that goal. I guess I should say allegedly, and that choice is not at all backed up by science. So there's my update on me quitting smoking. I'll be giving you an update every episode until the final show of the season where I will celebrate my triumph with all of you. Look, I warned you this show would eventually devolve into complete dogshit nonsense. I've been telling my guests it's only a matter of time, and apparently the time is now. Let me try to get back on track with some fly tying content though, because like I said, today's topic is one I'm currently nerding out about. Modern versions of traditional steelhead and salmon flies specifically tied on tubes, dudes. I'm pretty sure that the GP falls into the Spey and D family of fly patterns. God, I hope it does, because I'm not sure if you knew this, but I host a fly tying podcast, and if I'm wrong about this, I'm gonna sound like a real boob.
You bubble-headed booby!
I'll be honest though, before I talked to Joel, I thought a D fly was a specific pattern in itself, which isn't exactly true. Those patterns are named after rivers, and the flies that anglers have used on those rivers for generations now. The River Spey and the Aberdeenshire D. It can be confusing and similar to calling a two-handed rod a spey rod, which also isn't exactly true. And why do these European folks get to make everything confusing and put the word river in front of the name of the river? Should I start calling my local stream the River American?
Let me think about it for a second. No.
The Feather Emporium tells me spey patterns such as the Lady Caroline were first developed along the River Spey and displayed a character all their own. The hackling was unique. They used a spey cock side tail or a long heron hackle, and the wings were tied from mallard shoulder. Later, the D style of tying combined a wing with a long hook, slim body, and long heron hackles. However, it is not only the wing that set these two styles apart. The complexity of the patterns began to move in the direction of the Victoria era full dress salmon flies. Then, as the Victorian Empire grew around the world, more exotic feathers became more readily available to fishermen. The style of fly became very popular using these new materials on the River Dee. Thus, Dee-style flies were born, characterized by the following features. Large tags, tails, long and flowing hackles of heron, colorful bodies, occasional dropped jungle cock eyes at the head of the fly, and a V-shaped wing usually tied from turkey tail strips. Other patterns that fall into these families of flies are the Lord March, Miss Grant, Logie, Jimmy, Countess of Seafield, the Genie, Vivian, Glenlorin, Green Queen, and the previously mentioned Lady Caroline, along with many others. Again, check out Joel Hill's Instagram page because he posts a lot of super rad versions of these patterns. My newfound interest in these flies is like figuring out you dig a band that has been around forever and has a whole bunch of albums for you to listen to. I like to fish a two-handed rod and swing flies, and all of a sudden I had this whole new world to explore. But listening to music is easy, and I quickly realized that tying these patterns is pretty hard. I twisted up my first GP before I talked to Joel, and it's not great, but it wasn't horrible either.
Oh yeah, says Hugh.
In fact, I asked him for his critique, and he wasn't even that hard on me. Granted, we just met, so he probably wasn't going to tell me it's a piece of trash, but it gave me some confidence to keep trying. I'll share a photo of it in the show notes if you feel like checking out my first attempt and lambasting.
I thought about talking about this, but there's nothing more to add. There's nothing left to say. This is the worst one yet. There are no words.
I'm not afraid of you, or any of the horrible things that you have to say. The materials you need to make these can sometimes be tough to come by, but just like most other patterns, you can sub in something close enough. Don't go out hunting herons on your local river, okay? I am seriously stoked on the General Practitioner and all these other classic patterns. Tying them on tubes has me even more stoked. I've seen them since I started tying, but always just kind of wrote them off as being either too difficult or just impractical. Surely, fly patterns have gotten better and more effective by now. Bull honky, fish are dumb and love eating vintage patterns, so I hear. All this talk about D flies triggered a memory of mine from junior high school, and I probably shouldn't even include this because it's dumb and probably offensive somehow, but I'm gonna do it anyway because I mean no harm. Don't worry. I will apologize at the end, okay? Like I so often do. My best buddy in junior high's name is D. At least that's what we called him because his name started with D. He was not born on the River D. We both lived in a fairly rural part of Northern California, and I'd spent a lot of time at Dee's house on the weekends and during the summer. I was friends with his older brother too, and I got along great with his family. We did a lot of dumb shit that growing boys did before social media wasted all of our time, and we didn't live close to the city, so we had to get creative. Sometimes I was ripping horribly played instruments in the garage as loud as we possibly could and pretending that we had a band. Sometimes it was blending up weird food and laughing while we tried the grossest smoothies. I feel like I've mentioned that on a previous episode. We would always let Dee's dog Haas have a drink of whatever we made, and he was happy to be included, but never happy with the results. Anyways, this story isn't about that, but it is about dogs. You see, Dee shared a fence line with another kid from our junior high that we didn't bully or anything, but we didn't hang out either. We just existed in our own separate groups. To my knowledge, we never made fun of the neighbor kid to his face either. Probably behind his back to each other, but we didn't want to make him feel bad, at least as far as I can remember. Kids are mean though, so maybe I'm wrong. I guess we kind of half did, because we teased Dee's neighbor about his dogs being gay lovers on a pretty regular basis. His two large male dogs would come running down to the fence line anytime they would see or hear us in Dee's yard and would immediately start fucking each other and looking at us while they were doing it. If you have dogs, you know that when they get into hump mode, they kind of short circuit a little bit and get a spacey look in their eyes. Like we all do, I guess. We cracked up so hard every time we witnessed this and loved to tell the neighbor kid that his dogs were gay. He would try to laugh it off and stick up for him, but we wouldn't let it go, and it was easy not to let it go because every time we saw those dogs, they were humping each other, sometimes right next to the neighbor that was trying to defend them. The dogs seemed happy and were not embarrassed, and it was kind of mean to direct any sort of negativity towards the neighbor kid, but we couldn't help it. The fact that his boy dogs loved to have sex with each other was the funniest thing in the world to us. So, I'll use my first real apology for this episode to say sorry to the dogs. They couldn't help that they were in love with each other. And sorry to the neighbor kid too. He couldn't control his dog's passion. I want to apologize to any gay dogs that might be listening to this episode too. I'm sorry, everyone.
I apologize. They put me up to this.
I usually make fake apologies to kind of passively promote my past episodes, but this one is kind of real for the first time. I still think about it every now and then, and I laugh to myself and feel bad at the same time for not just laughing along with the neighbor, but using his gay dogs to tease him. I wouldn't trade the memory, though. We laughed until we cried, and our faces and stomachs hurt, and it was priceless. It might be one of the most important things for human sanity, in my opinion. Having real belly laughs and hurting from how bad you were laughing. It would make me feel so good if I knew that my show made people laugh like that. So I hope you enjoyed that story that is not at all homophobic. With each of these new episodes in Season 3, I start feeling embarrassed for my guests. I feel embarrassed for the listeners who might want to share this show with someone they know. Like, my guests signed up and agreed to let me interview them and showcase them on the show, and I have been going hard on toilet humor, almost promoting smoking and taking drugs, and I don't want my guests to feel like they made a mistake by being accessory to my perceived digital crimes. I can't help how stupid I am. I'm sorry. Again, if you've listened to my show, though, you know I keep it fairly professional during the interviews. It's these monologues where things get a little squirrely. Or squirmy? With that, I will end the insanity and welcome my guest for today's episode, Joel Hill, a creative fly tyer that has been inspiring me ever since I started following him on Instagram. He ties some seriously cool stuff, and you should follow him if you like to see awesome flies that other people tie, and you'll be even more pumped if you like traditional patterns and modern or just creative twists on them. So without any further ado, here is a naive and ill-prepared podcast host that is hungry for tube knowledge interviewing the very talented Joel Hill. Joel, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I got a lot of questions, and I hope you got some answers. but I just want to get some kind of initial getting to know you stuff out of the way. Like, so what part of Washington are you in again?
So I'm just south of Tacoma in Lakewood. So okay. North of Olympia, south of Tacoma. So
how did you end up there?
Man, I've lived in Pierce County all my life. Yeah, so Puyallup, Tacoma. Lakewood. I actually went to high school here in Lakewood too. So I didn't end up going very far.
Nice. So what's your home water then? What's your local water?
So my local waters, I fish a lot of the Cowlitz is pretty close. So I spend a bit of time there, and then the OP out in the winter time, I do a lot out there as well.
Cool.
So
Only been out there once. It was long ago. And it was so awesome. I want to go back. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great place. I've spent the better part of 8 years really trying to figure that place out. And last year was kind of the first aha moment. So it takes some time, man.
Right on. Yeah, I was lucky and got, you know, I hooked up with a great guide my first time out there. We had a blast. Only one day fishing, and it was great.
Nice.
On the Soul Duck.
Okay.
It was maybe 10 years ago now. Can't remember. Okay. But a long time ago. Anyhow, so how did you start tying then?
Well, my story isn't that much unfamiliar from other people's stories, but my grandpa got me started tying. So he used to take me fishing, and not just fly fishing, but all sorts of fishing. But the fishing that I really liked to do was he'd take me up in the mountains and we'd fish for cutthroat up in the mountain creeks. So I started creek fishing and started tying woolly buggers and stuff like that. And of course, as time went by, you know, kind of, you know, teenager and priorities changed a little bit and cars and girls, you know, type of thing. But I ended up getting back into it here probably, it's got to be 8 years, 8, 9 years, something like that. Just started getting back into it.
Your grandpa tied too, though?
A little bit, not a whole lot. So he kind of just showed me the basics, right? And it hasn't really ever been like a huge thing. Like he didn't have a tying room or anything like that. But yeah, actually, I think he got in trouble. My grandma at one point stepped on a hook and that kind of made things a little bit worse there. So,
yeah, man, it reminds me of a story when I was real little, probably 6 or 7 years old. And I don't have any, you know, fly fisher, you know, no fly anglers in my family that I know of, fishermen though. And my uncle, we moved into my parents' house and I was in the bedroom that he grew up in and he had some fishing stuff there. And one of them was a big fat saltwater, like a stick bait kind of thing with, you know, three big treble hooks on it, on the bottom of it. And I went running around the house with it and sure enough, like hooked myself like right under my chin in the throat.
Nice.
You know, so anyway, never forget it. But have you created, I mean, we all freestyle and stuff, but have you ever created a pattern that you've been proud enough to name and continue to tie it a bunch or?
Yeah, I've got a couple patterns, two that I've actually named. I only named them so that I had something to, well, no, I named one of them prior to you, but I was fortunate enough to sneak a couple flies in John Shuey's last book. So I've got two patterns in there. The Ho Sunset and the Quileute Sunrise. So
these are things I should have figured out before I talked to you. Actually, you should have found these things. I need to get the book. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool book, especially if you're into the history of spey flies. It's the second edition of this book. So, and the first one is great. I love that one. The second one is so much more in depth in the history of the Scottish River spey flies and the people that were tying them. Of course, that's the style of fly that I really like to tie. So,
yeah, way cool. Yeah, I the history part of it is super interesting to me, and I'm just kind of digging into those things. And I really, I mean, I started fishing with a two-handed rod like maybe 5 years ago or so. And okay. Like the thing that really kind of excited me about it was the history part of it from the Pacific Northwest, right? Like that kind of stuff, and right. those patterns and stuff too, intruders and all kinds of stuff. And now this part of it is starting to tickle my brain that way. And like, I'm diving into that stuff. I mean, so much that I didn't really think that, like, I thought spey and D flies were like specific, just patterns. Right. And, kind of just recently learned that they're more, they're way more than that. Right. And so what made you gravitate towards those kind of patterns then, you know, how'd you get into it?
So I've never really been a huge, like Facebook type of person, but I somehow found some fly tying communities on Facebook, right? And I was tying stuff like Intruders and stuff, you know, for, you know, because that's just all I'd ever really seen. And I started seeing more classic patterns through people tying. A good buddy of mine, Jason Miller, has a real big influence on me starting down the path of tying these crazy things. And it's just, I don't know, I'd spent a lot of time getting skunked. And so I'd tie something and it wouldn't work. And then, well, I got to tie something better. And then I come back and tie something better. You know, I was thinking like, oh, I'll, you know, when I figure out what works, I'll just tie that from now on. But that never happens. So I just keep tying different things. And it's just a lot of fun. So,
yeah. Yeah, they're super cool. And I love the like modern interpretations of them, you know, like the little twist that people are doing. And yeah, now the tube style stuff that I'm seeing. And you know, I was turned on to your stuff from Jim Sens, who's been on the show a couple
super
times.
Super cool guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Love Jim. And now, you know, researching you, I started watching some stuff on YouTube of Jason just the other day. So like, this is why I do the show. Like I'm finding out all right. These different things and I'm meeting people and then those fringe people that are around them too. So
yeah,
super cool. So I mean, I might be jumping a little bit ahead because I realize that this whole thing is like its own little rabbit hole within the rabbit hole that is fly tying. And yeah.
And each little rabbit hole you find has got a little offshoot over here, a little offshoot over here. And it's crazy, real
and
fast.
The people that are into these are like really into them. Right. And it's like, I see why. And so I'm starting to gather the patterns and stuff. And I just I'll text you a picture of it. I just tied my first GP last night. So awesome. I'm trying to do that now. If I'm going to kind of make an episode about the pattern, I'm trying to tie one close to it so that like, you know, I have a little bit more frame of reference and I'd love to get your critique on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we get into this, cause I don't think I did that bad, but there's definitely some things that I could do a whole lot better. So I'll send these over here just so I don't forget.
The GP, that's a fun pattern. Oh yeah, I see that you sent me something. I don't know how to look at it without getting out of here, but I'll look at it later.
Yeah, don't worry.
It's one of those patterns, it's not hard, but there's a lot of steps and then getting the proportions right on it because that part for me that's actually a really challenging fly for me. It's taken me a long time to get somewhat decent at that fly. I still don't think I'm all that great, but
I can see why. And like, but the way that I kind of broke it down myself is it felt like it was like a couple woolly buggers in there, like kind of stacked up and like dressed up a little bit. And so I kind of tricked myself into not being intimidated by it. Even though I don't do like the wing stuff very often, I'm just learning how to do this stuff. I definitely didn't like fix like what should be the eyes in the right way, the right spot. But I got to use some polar bear on there that I've been saving to try, and it's worked what I think was pretty cool for the tail. We'll see.
Yeah.
So how did you like, what was like, when did you start going tying them on tubes then? Like,
well, I've been dabbling with tubes here for the last couple of years, and I think I finally kind of got to where what I really like and what I think is going to fish well and work well. And tied a few for last winter and hooked some fish. I lost some fish, but my first steelhead to hand was a little wild hen last March, and it was on a GP tube, a black and red GP tube that actually a buddy of mine tied up for me. So yeah, it was pretty cool to see that all come to play. And since the one thing that I've always had a really hard time with the spay and D, I love the patterns. They're super fun to tie. They're beautiful, at least to me, but they're traditionally tied on long shank hooks. And a long shank hook with, once you pinch the barb on that thing, I mean, there's a lot of leverage there for that fish to throw that hook. Totally. So this is kind of my, I'm trying to, and I'm not the first person to tie these things on tubes by any means, but certainly trying to do it my own way. Right. But it's all based on trying to up my fish to hand ratio, hook a lot of fish, lose a lot of fish, make me want to figure out something else to try to make it work. So that's where the tube comes in. I can put a short shank hook in the back of that thing, and I feel like I got a better chance of landing that fish that way.
Yeah, that was one of the things I noticed about some of these patterns that you're putting on tubes of how you end up sitting the hook in the tube. And it seems like it looks more like the traditional fly still with like the same length and stuff without like a lot hanging out the back.
Yeah. The getting the proportions right on a tube and then not making it not look like there's a huge gap or the body's too short for the whole thing. It just, you know, the proportions look off, and it I'm sure it doesn't matter as far as, you know, to the fish or any of that, but certainly to me, because I mean, there's no reason to tie spay and D flies other than for your own selfish enjoyment, right? Like, you know, tie a woolly bugger, you're gonna catch steelhead with that thing if you want, but it's just what you choose to do, right? So I just like to try to offer something what I'm proud of apply that I think is gonna,
it translates to confidence too, like with the so like how do you know when a more classic pattern can be translated onto the tube platform? Like, how do you know, how can you look at it and see that you can do it? You know,
the truth is I don't until I try it
a shot. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of trial and error. I will say that with the spay flies, cause they typically have a longer hackle, so that kind of comes over the back of that and kind of gives you a little bit more wiggle room to making it not look awkward. You know,
okay.
I've got some, you know, some of these that I've tied up that are on my, so, and this one doesn't have a hook in it, but
yeah, but you can see how it sits right in there, and it looks, ends up looking really close to what it would be like on one of those hooks anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. You, and so I kind of try to make them just like a, like what they would look like on a AJ 2091, blind eye hook, but trying to make them so that they fish a little bit better for me too. So.
Yeah. Is what kind of tube is that? Is it all the same diameter, or does it have like the 40-40 kind of style fatter end on it, or?
So I'm tying these on brass tubes, and so I'm buying this stuff from like the hobby store. Mm-hmm. They come in like these little four packs. Oh, they're a foot long.
Yeah.
You can buy the same exact stuff from Canadian Tube Fly. And then they'll give you that. They're pre-cut with a liner in them. Makes it really easy. There's a penny or two to be saved to make them this way. Make them your own, cut them your own length, whatever you want. But I line them with the HMH micro tube. It's okay. Like a little 16th.
Slide it right in there. Fits in there. Yeah.
Yeah. And then just burn them in and then tie on that. So I think a couple advantages to tying on the metal tubes, at least for me, they hold their shape, right? So I like metal tinsel. So I can use the traditional metal tinsels that I have. It's interesting because if you shove a plastic tube on one of these needles and it, you start tying on it and it shrinks that tubing down, right?
Yeah.
So if you put a tube with metal tinsel on there, you pull it off and all that tinsel is all loose. Right. So, so that's one thing I really like about the metal tubes. And then the other is it gives it a little bit more weight and it's evenly weighted throughout the body. So I just feel like it swims a little bit better, more like a regular hook.
Like the hook would. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are some pattern or what are some signs then that a pattern like won't work? Like, do you ever see something and you're like, yeah, there's no way I'm not going to be able to translate that.
Yeah, I kind of thought that like full dress flies and stuff, but actually just the other night I tied a black dog, which is a full dress. It's got a topping, a full wing. But basically if you have a long hackle, that's going to be the length of the body. You can pretty much get away with it. The hardest part about this fly actually was the tail, because that junction tube makes it want to kick the tail up. So getting the tail to sit right, especially on those patterns, because the tail dictates the rest of the shape of the fly too, so makes it a little more challenging for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just feeling comfortable tying on tubes. I'm just started really, and like one of my main problems is getting the fly off, like you're saying, off of the adapter, right? Because it gets so tight when you're ranking the the thread down on and stuff. And even more, I'm an idiot. And I did an initial a tube episode in last season of the show. And I kind of at that point thought people generally tied tube flies backwards, like always. Because I had only really paid attention to like the reverse marabou and like the lava lamp, which are tied backwards, kind of. The more I tie on, the more I realize you can very much tie your flies the same regular way that you're used to. Are there any other like noob tips or misconceptions? Like for the only thing that's helping me with the getting the fly off is a lot of nose grease. You know.
A thinner thread. So I'm not sure what thread you're using, but I use
typically an 8-0, I think, usually.
Okay.
Yeah.
8-0 is what I use for most of my stuff. I'll use like a 100 denier kind of, or 120 for my underbodies if I'm making, trying to make something super smooth because it lays a little bit flatter, but just don't crank down on it real hard.
Yeah.
But if you're finding that, I mean, if you go the metal tube route, I mean, you can't crush it. So
very interesting. How are you cutting those tubes? What are you cutting the brass tube with at home?
So I was, up until just recently, just using a razor knife and kind of just scoring it and then breaking it in my hands.
Yeah.
But I found this little micro tube cutter
on
Amazon for like $9.
Hell yeah.
And it cuts things down to 16th of an inch, I think. So
fly tires ingenuity right there.
Yeah, and just finding stuff and figuring out what works and what doesn't.
Totally.
Kind of fun.
Yeah. I'm definitely probably cranking down too hard on the, you know, all the time. I mean, I could probably utilize a little more glue here and there and feel more confident, you know. And, you know, you mentioned, you were talking about keeping proportions and on the GP, right? I feel like I listened to you on a different interview where you mentioned in passing marking the hook. Right.
Yeah.
I had never heard before. And like I told you, I haven't been doing this for super long, so I may have just missed it, but it seems like, how do you just marking with a Sharpie right on there? And
yeah. So with a certain pattern, like the ball moral as a D pattern. So if I was going to tie that, like if I know that, you know, whatever my tube is, right, is so long, and I know that half of that has to be that body color, and then the next half has to be that, you can get real down to the wire with it and use a tape measure or something and then mark it with a Sharpie.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, cause I use white thread for my underbody, so I'll go all the way back to it. And then once I get, you know, where the end of my body is and the front of my body is going to end, I can cut that in half. Right. And just mark it with a Sharpie. And that kind of gives me a reference point. That one's actually really hard because that one's tied in thirds, and, or at least the way that I tie it, and that makes it a little harder.
It seems like it might be helpful, especially for that, since you tie it in thirds, that way you can kind of mark those thirds down or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause otherwise it gets a little, I don't know why thirds are harder than half and quarter to me, but they just are.
Yeah, that was interesting. And you know, I was going to ask too, in the videos that I watched that I was using to kind of tie my first GP last night, they weren't using any glue through the steps. Is it just because there's so much feather there that they don't want to, you know, it could muck it up? Or do you use glue throughout the process on the top?
I don't. I really don't. I don't have a problem with things pulling out. I don't know why. I just, it's one less step for me to make, right?
Yeah. I figured what happened was with the shell, you know, the three feathers on the top that I did. Mm-hmm. I just felt like they had enough movement on that they'd end up getting ripped out after a few casts, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just don't have I'm not giving myself enough credit here. I don't know.
It could be. One thing that I do with mine, as far as the carapace, all the three feathers on top, the first one and the second one, I'm tying in the full length of the next section of the body. And what that does is it just gives me more space to hold that stem down the entire way.
Right, yeah.
And then the last one, obviously you can't do that because you're all the way up to the very front. So I'll just tie it in and then I'll double the stem back over itself and then tie that on. And then that locks it in. So it's not going to come out. And then I use head cement on that part too. But as far as using glues and stuff, There's nothing wrong with it. It's just I'm lazy and it's going to take longer for me to wait for super glue or whatever to dry. I'm messy. I don't want it on my hands. So, I haven't had that problem where a whole bunch of my flies are falling apart enough to for me to change what I'm doing.
I haven't been using a whole lot of glue either, but I always feel like I should. And then, but I do on, at least on the tube flies that I've tied, I always try to put like a dab right before I put on like a cone or something like that on there. I see lots of folks that don't, and they just burn the end and the end keeps it in place. Do you do anything?
I don't use a whole lot of cones, to be honest with you. I did on the last GP that I made, and I've fished them that way. I don't really see a advantage to using glue on it because the, you know, if you burn it, it's going to cone out for you and keep that on there. Plus it's attached to the rest of the leader too. So it's not really going anywhere unless you break that fly off. So.
Yeah. Are you able to view those photos? I'd love to get your take on this, whether I can see you or not.
Let me see here. If I lose you, I'm sorry. I'll come right back.
It's all good.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Oh, come on. You're giving me too much credit right off the bat.
Well, I'm just looking at the proportions. Okay, no, it's great, man.
I didn't do that bad then.
No, I'm going to have to make one with the yellow tail or rump feathers of the GP because that looks awesome.
Oh, thank you.
I really like that.
That was leading to some more questions for you related to color selection and stuff. I'll be honest. I initially didn't even recognize this as being a prawn pattern, you know, when I was like initially checking out the GP. And quickly realized, you know, that it was.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've seen so many different color variations of it when I'm looking around online. And I had a kind of a hard time picking what to do. I ended up picking a black body. I had some like rooster hackle that seemed long enough to do the legs that was kind of orange.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I had this golden pheasant feathers on top that I felt like aren't as, you know, full or whatever, as you know, you see on other patterns where you see that distinct kind of like hard carapace look.
Yeah.
I debated on using guinea up there and a couple other feathers that I had, but then I realized that the GP got its name from golden pheasant too. Right.
Right.
And I was like, okay, well I have golden pheasant. I'm going to use it. So, you know,
so the rump of the golden pheasant is more like your regular ring neck pheasant. It's kind of more of like a webby spay hackle, but some of the red breast feathers on the golden pheasant, I've got part of one right here. So,
and I'll share a picture of this so people know what I'm talking about. Since I'm talking about this fly I sent you.
So these smaller ones, they're more dense.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And those are the ones that I kind of use for the carapace there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I have some strung. I don't have a, you know, a full.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Full thing.
So that stuff's getting harder to find too.
Well, my material want list is long, let me tell you. And I have a decent amount of stuff. I feel like I've started to compile a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's crazy how fast that ends up piling up, right?
Yeah. And I don't really have a room, you know, that I could dedicate it to. I don't have an office. I'm in my bedroom. I still have my jail cell background on, but I'm in my bedroom. and you know, I just have the clamp on traveler vise and the Renzetti deal. And
nice.
I just put it wherever I can and tie up and have my little setup and bring whatever I need, my shoe boxes out and put them where I need them. But yeah, the material list is long. One thing also on this is I feel like I have the wrong size tinsel. I think I have way too small tinsel. You can probably barely see it in there.
Okay.
I also saw some different people tying this GP pattern with floss at the butt section instead of dubbing all the way up. Do you have a preference either way there?
For fishing, for sure. I like dubbing for, especially in the back of a fly where I think you're going to get a grab, right? So you get a better chance of landing that fish, I think, if you get a little bit of dubbing stuck in that fish's teeth.
Sure, yeah.
Where floss is kind of, it's not going to give you that same advantage. I mean, whether that's a real advantage or not, I don't know. But
yeah, it looks buggy for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and then depending on where you want it to be in the water column too, so dubbing creates little air pockets in your fly. So if you don't squeeze it out in the water, it can trap some air in it and not sink as much. Whereas a floss body is a little thinner and it's got less mass, so it's going to go a little bit deeper. Sure. So okay.
I believe I heard you talking on another interview too about using ostrich to in place of chenille or dubbing. Did I hear that right? I don't think I've ever seen folks do it. Do you try that? Do you do that on the GP at all? Or do you do that for other patterns? Or
yeah, for sure I do that on the GP. I don't like chenille. I don't know if I even have any chenille. But if you want a little bit thicker body, I actually stole that from my buddy Jason too. I do a lot of copycatting on his stuff there.
Yeah, that's so what we do. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
That's cool, man. Yeah, I haven't tried that, but I think I will.
One thing that I do a little bit different than I think Jason does is he'll wrap one single ostrich hurl and then tie that off and then put another one in. I'll take two or three, tie them in, and then I'll twist them around my thread, basically making a chenille.
Yeah,
I think it's a little bit stronger. You don't get as pretty of a fly, but it takes probably half the time. And
some coverage there, though. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and the thread helps make it a little bit more. A little stronger. So
could we back up and could you run down like a quick list of the materials that you need to tie up a GP?
Yeah, so a traditional GP, the way that you're going to tie it, regardless of whether you're tying it on a tube or a hook, but it typically has some kind of hair for the tail. Polar bear is a real good one to use if you've got it. But I mean, I've used everything under the sun. I mean, if it looks buggy at the back end, I've used marabou at the back of it too. So I like to put a couple pieces of flash in that with that tail as well, one or two on each side. And then you can throw a first carapace really small over that. If you're tying it in thirds, then you would tie in your body section. Your first body section is either going to be dubbing and some kind of tinsel to one, keep that body together, and two, to kind of give it a little bit of flash up to the first section. Then you're going to have your eyes, whatever you're using. Traditionally, it's supposed to be the tippets of the golden pheasant. So those go out to the side, the kind of the neck feathers.
Supposed to look like the little stripe, supposed to look like the eye, right? Or whatever.
Yeah, the little black and orange bars. Those imitate the prawn eyes, or you can use whatever. I mean, I like using jungle cock, especially on a darker one. Like I really like a black GP, and if I'm tying a black GP, it's hard for me to not reach for some jungle cock to put there for eyes. Mm-hmm. I think it kind of gets lost in it in an orange one. So,
having trouble sleeping, having trouble pooping, having trouble meeting somebody who you can be yourself around, be open and honest with, express yourself with, share your feelings with. It's so hard to find a person you can really trust, somebody you know will treat you right, somebody who will be there for you when you need them and won't judge you for your past mistake, somebody who won't make fun of your body when you're naked. It's so tough to find that person, and if I'm being honest, you probably never will. At best, you'll end up settling for whatever comes your way that's willing to put up with you for a while. That's just how it goes. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't experience the best sleep of your life. That's where Mattress Cone comes in. Mattress Cone is a brand new direct-to-consumer mattress company that doesn't have any physical stores. They don't even have a real website. You order their mattresses on Instagram and they somehow offer free same-day shipping no matter where you live. The mattresses are really affordable and they come pre-scented so you don't have to apply your own oils and perfumes like you have to do with normal mattresses. Yeah, Mattress Cone mattresses are cone-shaped. They're conical. I'm not going to lie to you about that. They take some getting used to, but for the price and the aromas they offer and the same-day shipping, it's totally worth having a cone-shaped mattress. But don't take my word for it. Listen to what your host, Malt, has to say about Mattress Cone.
Hi, I'm Malt, the host of the award-losing podcast, Secret Society of Fly Tires, and I'm here today to give you my honest opinion about Mattress Cone. When they reached out to me to sponsor an episode, I was skeptical. Like the other guy said, they don't have a website and their mattresses are cone-shaped. Pretty weird, right? Wrong! It's not weird, and you shouldn't judge a book by its cover or a mattress by its shape. Long story short, they sent me a free twin-sized cone mattress, and I selected the spaghetti bolognese scent. And let me tell you, I sleep like a dead goose every night, and I wake up with a soaked pillow because the delectable aroma of home-style slow-simmered meat sauce and pasta makes my mouth water all the livelong night. That might sound like a bad thing, but it's not, because Mattress Cone planned ahead, and they sent me a box of their super absorbent sponge-style pillows that just soak up my drool, and they're soft and comfortable. Thanks, Mattress Cone. I thought you would be stupid, but I was stupid for thinking that, and I'm sorry.
I don't typically use them as much on that. And then it's just the red breast feathers from the golden pheasant, pretty much for the carapace and for the hackle as well. So the longer ones for the hackle. You can use whatever you want. I like using the breast feathers for that, for the hackle as well. So you just repeat that all the way up.
Yeah, I watched a lot of GP tie-in videos over the last couple of weeks, and there's a lot of variation. You know, like one thing I noticed is the difference in how many feathers people use as the top shell or the body. And like a lot, I've seen a lot of one single feather. I mean, all the way up to the three that I think is the more traditional route, right? Is three.
Yeah.
How much variation do you think you can like put on that until you don't call it a GP anymore? I mean, like, what does it need to have?
As long as it's got the same profile, as long as you can distinguish it, like that looks like a GP. I'm going to call it a GP. The same profile, the same shape. I mean, I have one actually. A buddy of mine gave me from that Art Lindgren tide, and it's got just a hackle tip for the wing, for the carapace, and it's tied into the very front. It's pretty sparse. It's a gorgeous little fly. Let's see if I can find it. I'd show it to you. But.
Yeah, the colors, I mean, you're talking about the all black, which has kind of been, I didn't, that's like my go-to is just like usually black flies, a little bit of color mixed in, just personal preference. And I kind of didn't want to go that route with my first GP because I, you know, wanted to look a little more prawny. But I have a problem. I always have a problem with, that's tight. You know, that's super cool.
Yeah, so this is just a hackle tip.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he's only tied one in, and it's right at the very front. But, I mean, you can tell it's a GP all day long. It's just tied differently. Yeah. So
that's what I love about this stuff, man. You don't have to have any golden pheasant on it, really, even though that's what it's named after. And the root of the thing is there, and it's got the same idea. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a hard time with color selection. It's like I don't have all the colors, right? So I limit myself, you know, whatever it is, if it's fur or feathers or dubbing or whatever. And I always feel like I'm going to use too many that don't really go well together. But if you go all black with most of it, just a couple little accents usually, yeah, works out for you, you know.
It's very hard to get me to tie or to fish anything either. It's either nowadays it's either black or pink.
Yeah.
So those are my two go-to colors.
Here, let's find some other questions I had for you. I'm losing track. Well, man, I'm happy with your critique. I thought it was like, well, man, you need a lot of work. That's what I was expecting.
Okay, so if you want, like, you know, one thing I would say is the first carapace feather. If you can make that a little bit shorter, it would show off that tail a little bit better. But other than that, I mean, it looked pretty spot on to me.
Cool. The goal is to kind of have them staggered enough where you're only like halfway up with the feathers that are going in front of them, right?
Yeah.
So
they kind of overlap about half, about 50%.
Yeah, I need to get a full golden pheasant. So I got the whole mix.
They're harder and harder to find every day. So when you do, price is going up. So
yeah. Well, I'm just getting into this hobby store hawking stuff for finding certain things, you know, because there's certain stuff that, I mean, obviously you're going to get from the fly shop, but there's a lot of things that you can find super cheap. Even if you're just like looking on Amazon and you just put like craft in there instead of fly tying, you know, like you find all kinds of stuff. So the tube
for almost half the price.
Yeah. I haven't gone down the tube rabbit hole there though. Cause I start just adding all these things to like my wish list. So I don't forget that they're there. And I like, if I need something, I can remember they're there. But sticking on the prawn theme, fishing saltwater for sea run cutthroats up there has always been something that I wanted to do. And my brother lived up in Seattle for 5 or 6 years. And when I went to visit him up there, I'd gone to the OP. So I didn't stick around and do any of that. And it's always sounded awesome. I love fishing saltwater. Could you maybe go through some flies that you would want to tie to bring along with you for a trip like that?
Yeah. So, man, I tie kind of shrimpy looking things for sea run cuts. The other one that I like to fish a lot is a chum fry. And it doesn't seem to really matter what time of year you're fishing for sea run cuts. But they seem to really like those squiddy patterns too. Anything that's got a lot of movement and pulses.
They're eating that stuff. The sea run cut, they're eating baby squid and stuff out there.
Yeah.
In the sound, yeah.
The Kinney reverse spider, or Mike Kinney's pattern. That's really cool. I'm probably going to get a lot of hate for even mentioning that fly, but
oh no, should I redact it and beep? I could beep it to make it funny.
I've posted that a couple of times, and people are like, "You fucker, quit mentioning that fly."
Oh man, I love it. Wow, my audience is small anyway. Word won't get out, dude. just to more nerds that want to tie it up.
Yeah, no, it's a great pattern. So
yeah,
I don't mind sharing that one at all.
What kind of setup, rod and line wise, do you prefer out there?
I have a Reddington Predator 9 foot 5 weight that I fish a lot. If I feel like there's a coho in the area, I've got a 7/8 weight rod that I built, also 9 foot. You know, if there's a chance for coho to be around, I typically fish that. But I recently started. Well, I've made a few rods. Well, I should rephrase that. I'm not making rods. I'm building rods, right?
Yeah. What kind of rods?
Components that you buy.
Yeah. What kind of rods are you building?
A buddy of mine has his own rod manufacturing company, so he's here in Steilacoom, pretty close to me. Cool. It's a Flying Fox rod and tackle.
Okay.
So Neil is a really good guy. He's been teaching me how to wrap rods, and I don't know where he's really getting his blanks from, but I know a good rod blank when I like soft medium action rods. So anytime I find one of those, I'm like, I need to build that. I gotta have one of those. So one that I really like fishing, and I actually caught a coho on it here in the Sound this summer, and it wasn't a huge coho. It was, you know, four or five pounds maybe. If I'm embellishing, it's probably 4 or 5 pounds. But I caught is a 3/4 weight 11-foot trout spey, and man, that thing is just a ton of fun to hook a Scandi line in the salt.
Yeah, I got one of those. That's cool that you can use them in salt too. I mean, I guess you're not in really like surf or anything like that, so it's
it's pretty calm. So yeah. I'm fishing outgoing and ingoing tides in the safety of the harbors and such. So
yeah, you think, is it something that you feel like you should like get a guide, or at least go out with somebody that knows what's up? Or do you think that somebody totally fresh could just kind of go out there and luck into some fish maybe?
You know, you certainly could, but you know, there's nothing about going on your own and trying to figure it out yourself that's gonna, you know, put you into fish real fast.
Yeah,
I'm kind of a do-it-yourself guy, and so that's kind of why it's just taken me longer. But all of the knowledge that I get kind of it's kind of gratifying, right? To figure it out yourself. I've never had a guide. I went on one guided trip with my dad and my brother, but we were throwing spinners for coho, and that was still really fun. But they're not fly fishermen, so I mean, well, they're fly fishermen in training. I built them both rods, so I just got my dad to start using them.
Yeah, man, especially if you make it, then they feel like they got to do it, right?
Yeah, for sure, right? Write their name on it and say, here, yeah. I made you a rod, now you got to go with me.
Put their name on it, hell yeah, dude.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had interest in rod building. Is it kind of like the eventual life cycle of a fly tire? You just kind of eventually end up wanting to make everything that you fish with, or anybody?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it kind of depends on what kind of fly fisherman or fly tire you are too. There's a lot of people that like, well, I just want to tie a pattern that I know works, right? And I don't care, you know, about the artistic merit of it or whatever. That's not the kind of fly fisherman or fly tire I am. Like, if I catch fish on a fly, I'm like, okay, well, what else works? I'm going to try something else, right? Where a lot of people will just, they'll keep that same pattern on. That's their go-to, and that's what they're going to use, right? But I just like it. I just think it's fun to experiment and explore. So,
yeah. Yeah, I don't know what kind of fly tire I am. That's an interesting question I never thought about. But I guess I'm a little different there. When I know something works, I want to keep tying it. And I like to just kind of make it different, you know, just kind of like perfect it or something, you know, like I love the graboid leech, farmer's leech. And yeah, do you have a leech pattern you like? You're a steelhead guy. You got to have a leech, right?
I mean, I'm not going to say that I don't have a bunny leech or two in my fly box, but I don't really have any kind of like, you know, patterns. But again, that's just because I like to change it up all the time too, right? And so most of my box is going to have traditional styled patterns. They're not going to be perfect to the letter, because I don't know, man. I can't follow directions all that well. So, I mean, if I got a general idea of what it's supposed to look like and what materials, I'll just kind of run with it. And that's why you see variation of this, variation of that. I mean, that's kind of, I don't know. That's what I like about steelhead, right? Is, you know, it doesn't have to be a certain pattern. They'll eat a car bumper if they're close enough to the salt, right? I heard somebody say that. Who was that? I don't remember. But anyway,
it actually sounded familiar to me too. I don't know. Yeah,
it's right on the tip of my tongue. I know who said that. Bill Herzog said that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But it's true. I mean, the fly doesn't matter so much. The, you know, how you present it and just finding fish is more about what matters. And that leaves a whole lot of opportunity for me to just tie whatever I want.
Yeah.
And let my mind explore.
Yeah. I like getting stoked and seeing a pattern that I don't tie and like wanting to tie it and getting the stuff if I don't already have it to try it out. And I might not dig it. You know, I might not like the pattern once I finish it or something, or feel like I'll ever use it or something like that. I end up definitely tying what I know I can do pretty well. I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't waste stuff, you know, I don't know. But I do like, and I'm trying to do this with my show is tie one up at least and then give it a shot. And I did that for a lot of episodes that I've done, but there was a few that I didn't. Like I tried tying a game changer and it was just not for me. And, you know, I don't think I ever will, but
there's a lot of steps in that. Yeah, for sure.
I like you're saying, you know, I don't like following directions either, but I do like now, especially now that I'm kind of learning more of the nuances of tying, like looking at a lot of videos of the same pattern and seeing like mm-hmm. all the different ways people do stuff, and then kind of knowing what I have to do before I get to the vise to try it, and then not just have to watch and like take it step by step. And I'll watch a whole bunch and see what people do. And then I'll pick off the ones that I think I like and like the style that they do it, and then kind of try and match that a little closer, you know?
Yeah.
I definitely saw a lot of GP videos that I was like, no. Like, I don't know if you've looked at GP tube tying videos on YouTube lately.
I haven't. No, I haven't.
I wasn't sure if I'd find one on a tube, but there was three or four of them or something like that. And a couple of them looked, I was like, why would I copy? It looked horrible. It's huge, you know, and like, you know, everybody has their own style, but I just like finding, even with something simple like clouser, like I tied up some clousers for the saltwater just a couple weeks ago. We were going out for striper and I watched a bunch of clouser videos. My buddy's like, why are you watching all these clouser videos? You know how to do it. I was like, yeah, there's little things that different people do, especially West Coast stuff too, with Steve Adachi and the deep minnow and stuff, and the way that he does the clouser, you know. Anyway, I like seeing it all. I like seeing what people do. That's the cool part for me.
Yeah, clouser minnow too for the sound.
Oh yeah,
can't go wrong with that. So
in shrimpy colors or like in minnow colors or probably both, eh?
I think the one that I've had the most luck with was white and chartreuse on the top.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so and tied real sparse.
Yeah, what you'll use for the big striper out here anyway, right?
Yeah. I tie mine on little size 4 saltwater Gamakatsu hooks.
Oh, cool.
With the barbell eyes. So.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
So BC has been on my bucket list for a long time.
Yeah.
Ever since I got into the Steelhead, and I haven't been up there. And I just, a guy I know just went, got a big fish last week up there. And I know you went recently too. Was that your first time?
Yeah, that was my first time fishing BC. So I was lucky enough to get invited up by a friend of mine.
Oh, cool.
Pat Meester on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
He's the Cutthroat Coast on Instagram. Super cool guy operating out of Powell River, BC. Some of the coolest cutthroat fishing I've ever seen in my life, and just some gorgeous country up there. So yeah.
What's the difference there with cutthroat from where you're from and going up there to do it?
They haven't had 500,000 people throw a whole bunch of stuff in front of their face, and they're big. They get really big up there too. So there's a lot of their cutthroat that are running from lakes to rivers, and they get pretty big, eating kokanee. So really cool experience. Biggest cutthroat I've ever caught was up there with Patches. I think it was every bit of 21 inches. So it was pretty big for me.
Oh yeah.
So
that's rad.
And they get bigger than that too. I mean, that was what I got. But and then helicopter steelhead fishing up in the fjords, you know.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a dream.
That was something
dream.
I'll never forget.
Yeah, it's dream stuff. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Man. You get into some big fish up there too?
Yeah, there's some big fish. I hooked and lost two steelhead up there and definitely got schooled. But yeah, Patches and Brad, they both, I mean, we're all fishing together. It wasn't like a guided thing. We're just buddies fishing. And they both caught steelhead up there. And it was just so cool to just even be part of that whole experience, you know. Even though I didn't land one, it didn't matter. It was just everything about it.
You fought a couple of them, though. That's rad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it does feel good as long as it's not a full skunk, right? And so part of your crew gets into a big fish like that. It feels great. You get a victory there for sure.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, I got to get up there. I mean, yeah. I don't know if you'd want to answer, but like, and I guess you got invited too, so maybe it's not the same. But how roundabout how much could you put together? How much would a trip up there would it cost to put together? What do you think,
man?
You know, I've looked at Alaska and stuff like that. I've looked at, and it can get, you know, probably it's like $5,000 to $10,000 if you want to get up there for a week, right? And
yeah, I can't imagine it's going to be any different than that.
Something like that too, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, bring your checkbook. I freaked out when I got up there and had to fill up my gas tank. I was like, holy moly! I think equivalent to here in the States, I think it was like $8.33 a gallon.
Holy shit.
Just, yeah. So, and the ferries are expensive. That was, you know.
As soon as you cross over, it's
yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And I almost, you know, before I crossed the border, I was like, maybe I should fill up again. And I was like, I'm in a hurry. I don't want to wait in line for too much longer. So, that was a mistake. I should have filled up before I got across the border. But so, yeah. Definitely fill up before you hit the border.
Yeah, I got to do it. I got to just make it happen.
Yeah.
Pretty. So you're a dad like me, and I want my kids to love fishing, you know, and mm-hmm. I hope they become my future fishing buddies. But I wrestle with bringing them out with me because I get selfish and I want my solitary time on the water. You know, it takes patience to fish and even more patience to fish with kids.
Yes.
You have any tips on battling through that stuff?
Oh, well,
your kids like to fish with you?
Yeah. First and foremost, don't force them to, for sure. My son has no interest in fishing, and that's totally fine. It's not his thing. But my daughter, she loves to fish. She's getting pretty good at casting. She still has the attention span of a gnat though. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of like trying to set her up for success and get her into fish as quick as possible so that she'll want to keep doing that. Right. And then, you know, if we don't get into something, then she wants to go look at rocks or, you know, look under rocks and stuff like that. And that's fine. And then I try to hook a fish and hand her the rod. A lot of the times that reels her back in, but always bring snacks. never leave without a whole bunch of snacks, because as soon as they're hungry, it's time to go. And then just realize that it's not fishing time. It's hanging out with your kids time and making sure that they're having a good time. I think that's the key to making them want to come back. So
yeah, for sure. That's good advice, man. Yeah. And I definitely don't force it on them. Like I said, they probably would go with me way more than I let them, you know? And
yeah,
they're getting older though, and able to, you know, be trusted wandering around, you know, and stuff with why I'm fishing too, if they want. So we're getting there.
Yeah.
I'm confident one of them will pick it up. It might be my daughter too. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are special times too. I mean, being able to spend some time out on the river, anywhere fishing in the Sound with my daughter is just, I wouldn't trade that for the world.
That's awesome, man. Just got a couple more questions for you here. So I listened to your interview on Wet Fly Swing, and in another kind of passing comment, you'd mentioned being in a band and kind of living that lifestyle for a while.
Yeah.
And then stopping and kind of pivoting into fishing and tying at some point, right?
Yeah.
Did I hear that right? Or just make up a fantasy scenario, like kind of like my own, because I kind of did the same exact thing, you know?
No, that's very true. So music has been a big part of my life from high school on.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, I was a drummer in a metal band.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I was going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and even before that, I've been a mediocre guitar player for most of my life. I did have a guitar teacher at one point just told me I was unteachable. I can't read music. Yeah, I can't read music to save my life, right? So, but I can hear a song and I can play it. I know what chords are and stuff, and I know what a G chord is on the. But as far as like learning scales and reading music and stuff like that, I could never do it. I still play. I play with my brother and my brother-in-law. We play. So we're basically just old aging punk rockers with bluegrass instruments. So,
oh, cool. All right. That's cool.
My brother-in-law plays the upright bass. My little brother, he plays anything with strings on it, and he's enough to make you just pissed because he's so good at whatever he picks up.
Yeah, this is so parallel to me, man. I play with my brother still, and he plays circles around me. Always yeah. my little 7 years younger than me.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Mine's 10 years younger than me. So yeah, not all that far off.
Right. It's like, no, we had to show them, right, that we could do it.
Yeah.
And then they're like, yeah, we'll check this out. You know, they put way more effort into it. And
yeah, when I was learning, there wasn't any YouTube, man.
That too. Yeah, exactly. Right.
So
I'm in the same boat though. I played punk and metal my whole life, you know, and I didn't, awesome. I didn't, you know, I took music in school and didn't do well, and learned how to read music for a brief period of time, probably enough to pass a couple tests at school.
Yeah. And I didn't even do that.
people say you don't forget that. It's like riding a bike. I'm like, yeah, fuck you. Like I forgot it right away, you know, right out the window, but I do have a good ear and I could figure some stuff out pretty fast, you know.
Yeah.
Especially because none of the stuff I like is very easy or is very hard, you know. It's like I like, you know, shitty punk that people were under 20 years old than when they recorded, right, and were no good anyway, and
right,
you know, so how hard could it be to figure out? But
right, exactly.
Yeah, that's cool though. That's cool you're still doing it too. Did it take you a while? You take like a break from doing it, like were you, was it like a focus for a long time, or you know?
Yeah, so after I was not playing metal anymore, it's always been a camping thing. So the way that, and we're still playing, so it's the Cottonwood Campgrounds on the Ho River is kind of where my wife's family has gone for family camping trips for her entire life. Okay. And so I'm part of that tribe now, and we'd go there and we'd play music and drink way too much. And, you know, at a certain point, somebody gets a wild hair up their ass, and you know, we're a band now, you know, we're gonna play an open mic or something, you know. Yeah. And that's literally how it happened.
Yeah,
so it's always just been about fun with these guys, but it's not too serious. You can't take it serious at all. So
I mean, I took it serious for so long, and then like I took a break actually when my Tony, my brother, moved up to Seattle. He's always been my partner, and now coming back to it, like I stopped it being a focus of my life. Like this is what I want to do. Like when I was like 30, 42, mm-hmm. 42 now. and just getting back into playing in a band, like with my brother. And the group of guys we have is so easygoing. Like, we all get along great. There's no pressure. It's all just about fun. And like, it's like, it's the coolest experience I've had playing music. And every breath was trying to be a musician for at least 10, 15 years, you know? And it's yeah. funny when you drop that, how much better it is.
For sure. Yeah. I don't miss closing down bars and on Wednesday night in Seattle. That's no fun.
I've done plenty of those. Yeah.
I'm 42 now. I can't do that.
Oh yeah. We're same age too. Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, and I guess it's different if you make it. Right.
Oh, for sure.
That's all worth it. But you know,
yeah, if you don't have to have a day job and that's what you do, right?
Then yeah,
you know, whatever. But yeah, I got to pay some bills, man. I can't do music, so
exactly.
Yeah.
So I ask every guest this question, totally unrelated to fly tying, but have you ever had a paranormal or supernatural experience?
Ooh, yes, I have.
Oh wow, well, fair, man.
Okay, so, and I still don't know what the hell it was that we were looking at, but my daughter had this science project for school that we're supposed to go and look at certain phases of the moon, right? And she's supposed to draw them out and stuff. And we're out in the backyard looking at that. And we look up over across on the other side over the lake, and there's like six lights that are moving very, very weird. Like, not, I was like, what is that?
They weren't like in formation, they were just kind of random or something.
A random for sure, but very clustered. And then they kind of go away and then they come back. And I don't know. It was just, I still don't know what it was, but I saw something weird. So
how long did it last? Like, how long were you guys watching them?
Oh, it had to have been 15 minutes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was wild. Yeah, I was like, are you seeing this?
Who else are you? Was it just like, you and your kid, or was there other people there?
Yeah. Were there crazy mushrooms on my pizza? Like, what what is this, right? But yeah.
Wow. Well, so I can only imagine. I've had a sighting. I've gone through the story on the show before, and it's kind of just your classic, you know, UFO sighting or whatever. But the thing about mine was that it was pretty close too. The thing about mine was like the ship that or whatever I was seeing changed shape like drastically, and it was daytime, so it was a little different than seeing light. Was it night when you saw these lights, I'm assuming? Yeah This was before it got dark, and the shape of what it was, I mean, changed a dozen times or something in the 5 minutes that I saw it, right? I don't know what it was. At one point it did look like a classic saucer shape thing. And my now wife was with me at the time. We were walking our dog, and I went underneath this patch of trees because it was going in this direction, and I wanted to keep following it. And she stayed where she was, and she looked up and saw a clearer view of it than I ever did, because when I got through the other side of the trees, it was disappeared and it was gone. But she said it looked like an Indian plate, like patterned on the bottom, kind of like a, you know, some kind of clay pot or something, like,
wow,
you know, geometric shapes. But like I said, it changed a bunch of times. It went from a pencil, like a thin pencil line you could see in the sky, to like a full circle, like a compact disc, like a CD, like full circle. Looked like a Mylar balloon at another time, like kind of floating around. It was a weird sighting. But
how big?
Well, it was probably 200 yards away or so when I saw it first. It was like floating over near a shopping center. And then it came our direction. And I think the closest that we were, it was probably 100 feet, 200 feet over the tree line. And the tree line was probably 60 feet or something like that, 50 feet tall.
Wow. So it was pretty big.
Pretty close. As far as how big the thing was when we were there, like I said, it changed shape so many times, it's really hard to judge. When it was closest to us, I would say it was probably in the realm of like a van.
Oh, okay.
Something like that. Something, you know, a bass boat. I'm trying to frame a reference for this. I don't know. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to say. My wife barely remembers it. She's like, did that really happen? I'm like, yeah, it fucking happened. Like, I remember it like vividly, but 15 minutes is a long time to see something like that. What kind of things were going through? Like, what was the conversation like with your daughter? What did she think it was? What do you think it was? You know,
it was my wife, my daughter, and myself were out there. And that's all I remember thinking was, what is that? What is that?
Yeah.
What is that? Right. Like, I just, and it didn't seem like it was one thing either. Right. Like, it's just a bunch of lights. And like, at first, you know, I was thinking like, yeah, that maybe it's a helicopter. No, there's like 8 of them. Like, and what is that? And that was all I could think, man.
Well, were you guys scared at all?
No, or at least I wasn't. I can't speak for them, but I don't remember them, you know.
Wasn't close enough to be like afraid something was going to happen or anything.
It was pretty far away. Yeah.
That wasn't
It'd be
scared.
A little yeah. bit different if they were like hovering over our backyard, right? But other side of the lake, not so much.
I mean, this was really close to our house too. We weren't walking that far from a house, and I wasn't scared in the moment, but I would say describe myself as scared later that night thinking about it. You know, I don't, in retrospect, like, I don't know. Like, I felt like, I remember there was other folks out on the block and when we were walking and none of them were looking at it, right? Like, we were like watching it this whole time, you know, like on this kind of small street. There's other people out in the yard and I looked around and I didn't go like, hey, everybody, you see this? But none of them were looking at it. Like, I remember looking around to see if anybody else noticed it and they didn't. And it kind of felt like it was for us in a weird way. Which, if you get it, if this is something you're interested in or not, but
yeah,
I mean, I'm real, real interested. I mean, like half of the show that I do here ends up talking about all this weird stuff and half of it's fly tying really. And it seems like a lot of these scenarios turn out to be kind of personal, you know, these right. sightings, you know, whether you view it as spiritual, which a lot of folks do, they all have their own lens or whatever it is. And maybe that's part of the phenomenon itself, is like appearing like how they you would be accepting of it or something, right? Or to get your attention in a way. There's all sorts of theories, however deep in the woo-woo you want to get, you know?
Right.
But yeah, that's what kind of, that's what made me a little scared, was that it felt like it was for us. And, you know, nothing happened except for I just got super obsessed with reading about UFOs and stuff. Like, ever since, I was like, what, 20 years ago or something, you know, and like definitely piqued my interest and just got me going. So,
wow. That's cool, man. That's definitely the only experience like that I've ever had. And I don't know. Yeah. I can't say that it was anything spiritual. I think the closest thing to spiritual I ever get is spending time on a river by myself.
Okay. Yeah.
But, yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't have any idea. Well, I have a little bit of a theory, I guess, about all this stuff. It would take me forever to talk through it, but I don't know how. I think there's probably all types of those experiences. I don't really discount anybody's view of what they saw, right? But, you know, I love reading about them, and it sure is a really interesting time to be into the subject after 20 years, and now it's like mainstream news, and there's like all kinds of talks about, you know, UFOs in general, or UAPs as they call them now, and, you know, hearings and stuff happening, and it's wild.
Yeah,
man, I love asking that question. I usually get a no, so I'm stoked that you had a story for me.
Yeah, you know,
I get a no. And it's probably half that they don't want to tell a stranger their weird story, and half it just doesn't happen to everybody. And
right.
I'm pumped to have a story here, man. So thank you. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. Yeah. No problem, man.
And thanks for coming on the show, man. We got through a whole bunch of questions and ended up going off on a couple little tangents that I think people will dig. I sure did. I mean, I learned some stuff, and, you know, through looking up, researching you, like I said, I'm finding these other folks like Jason, and you mentioned a couple other things on the show already that are going to make me, you know, start Googling, and there's a book I need to buy, and there's all sorts of stuff. So
yeah,
man, appreciate it.
Well, thanks a bunch for having me, man. I really appreciate it. It's fun.
Yeah. Great, man.
Good to nerd out about some fly tying stuff.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks again, Joel. I really appreciate you being down to come on the show and for sharing your wisdom. I learned a lot from this one. Maybe you did too. If so, please Venmo me $39.95 for today's virtual seminar. I'll relay 50% of that to Joel, after taxes, of course, and we'll all be happy and rich together. You with knowledge and me with your money and the knowledge.
Now you're looking at the world's richest man.
I'm having fun with season 3. I'm letting it all hang out. This is me, all natural. I have broken free of the shackles of judgment after the first 2 seasons. Not like you were all judging me or anything. I really haven't heard much negative feedback at all, actually. That will change after this season, though, I promise. I'd love some. I told you before that I'd love a podcast war, or at the very least, a listener that relentlessly trolls me. I really have no idea how ridiculous this season will end up. At least I talked about flies this time. I go through phases of which patterns really pique my interest, and I went from not being familiar with Joel to him being one of my favorite tires. All it took was one quick Zoom chat. Joel Hill and Jonathan Farmer both craft up creative versions of classic patterns, and I can't get enough. I'm still obsessed with leeches, don't get me wrong.
Ah, the leech.
But the GP and other spay and D patterns are becoming my latest obsession. I'm starting to acquire the necessary materials, and will definitely be tying more of them in the future. I got a bunch more episodes in the hopper to fill out season 3, and I've found some motivation, so I'll be cranking through them and releasing them on my usual 2 per month schedule. Coming up soon, I have Eric Clymore from Small Batch Bugs. That episode is on the Chattahoochee River. I'll also welcome back Truckee's finest, Gilligan Coles, to talk about his new handmade Truckee speed rods. I also have an episode with Rob Beckius from Two Hand Hardware Company coming up, and one with Andy Gibbard on the closing of Keeney's Fly Shop and my local creek, the Lower American River. Stay tuned, please. Between my episodes, you should check out the stuff that these people are putting out. John Levi. I've thrown in a few sound clips from John's channel on my own show, and I watch his new videos every Sunday night. His voice is great, and the content is really interesting if you're into considering wild alternative theories about our history. I love it. His channel is dedicated to exploring the forgotten history of humanity and other mysteries. Truth requires leaving the comfort of belief behind. His material is intended for entertainment purposes only. Should I be saying that about my show? His videos may expand your mind and liberate your soul. Please consult a mainstream expert before consuming any of his material. Side effects may include seeing life as it really is, questioning everything, and a sense of wonderment as you see the world with new eyes.
Here I want to focus on ruins with no history. You'll remember in a past video I said, how would we know if something was a ruin or a pre-Columbus ruin? Something from a more ancient people than ourselves. And in my opinion, it would be again twofold. There would either be no history, or there would be a stupid history.
Next up is Michelle Gibson. Michelle's channel is in the same realm as John Levi's, but with longer form videos and a slightly different approach. Here's her channel description. I am convinced that if we knew our true history, there would be no mysteries in history. I was first fascinated by megaliths, and my life's journey has led me to uncovering the key to the truth about the ancient advanced civilization that built the Earth's infrastructure. From ancient to modern, and cataclysmic events which destroyed this civilization and ushered in the new world by those behind what has taken place here for the purposes of power and control. Michelle found a star tetrahedron on the North American continent by connecting the dots of major cities and extending the lines out. Then she wrote down the cities that lined up primarily in circular and linear fashion and got an amazing tour of the world of places she had never heard of with remarkable similarities across countries. I can't get enough of this stuff. If these quick plugs got you interested, please give them a listen. I'll make sure to link to them in the show notes too. Thank you for listening.
Shut up and listen up. This episode of the Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by The Antidote. Do you have symptoms? Do you suffer from unnamed maladies and pains? Do you ache or itch or throb in ways that are off-putting and upsetting? You and me both. Luckily, there's a cure for what ails you, and it's The Antidote, and I've got it, and I'm willing to sell it to the highest bidder. There's only a single dose, but worry not, for one gentle sip from Vine Elixir is sure to alleviate any symptom you may be experiencing. exhibiting. That's right, my antidote cures anything and everything, from migraines to strep throat to internal warts to groin aches to unspeakable loneliness. Just head over to ebay.com and look up the antidote and place your bid. The auction ends soon, so act now. Bid for your chance to live a perfect life.
Please note that this is not a real advertisement, and the company, brand, entity, or product mentioned in the preceding ad in no way endorses, agrees with, or knows about this podcast.